Is anybody excited about doing prayers? Probably not. But these are really important to set our intention for the practice. So here's what we're going to do on page, in the gold book on page 34. We're going to go right through the first two pages. And we're going to do it in English. Okay, so how many people are new? I think I see some new faces here. First time? Okay, well, welcome. So, I'm not going to spend a lot of time explaining to you why we do these prayers, but they're not empty rituals. They have meaning, and if we, you know, once you have a chance to study these and understand the meaning, it can be quite powerful in terms of setting your mind up for successful practice, either meditation or study. So the first one we're going to do is taking refuge in bodhicitta. And I will say this, there's two motivations that are important, probably three, for taking refuge. Excuse me. The first one is called you know, it's kind of a dumbed down term, but the text describes it as fear. But most people see that as kind of a bad word and paralyzing. But dread really does describe it. It's kind of like having some sense of like my life is out of control to some degree. Certainly my mind is out of control. And if things go on like this, as I get older and then eventually sick and have to face my own demise, things could get pretty crazy. And so I dread the thought of going forward in my life with a mind that's out of control, basically, and the consequences of that, both short and long term. So that's number one. The other reason for taking refuge is confidence that, for example, the enlightened beings and their teachings and the realization of those teachings in their minds and eventually in our minds and the spiritual community, that they are that's a reliable source of guidance. So there's this dread, this confidence, and then the third one is compassion. For ourselves and then for other people, because eventually what we'd like to do is to be able to help others in every conceivable way to stop their suffering and find their own true, lasting, stable happiness and joy and freedom. So that's another motivation for us taking refuge. So those three things. So we'll do that. Then we'll do the four measurables, immeasurable love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, and then the seven-limb prayer, and then the mandala offerings, kind of like imagining we're offering the universe for the teachings. It's like, you know, if we saw these teachings as like the key, you know, out of our suffering to true lasting happiness, we would offer everything we have, wouldn't we? We'd be so grateful for that. So, some people do this, I do it, just to, it's, you know, in almost every religious tradition, people put their hands at their heart when they do prayers. I think it helps to speak from the heart, but doesn't necessarily guarantee that, does it? All right. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment, friends, and hatred for enemies. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha film and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niyataya Me, which means I send forth this jewel mandala to you, precious teachers. Alright. So that's enough for now with the prayers. Now we'll start out doing a little meditation, and maybe for about 5 or 10 minutes, let people. If you've never meditated ever, and the people in the back, have you meditated? Yeah, okay. Well, the main thing is just to sit up straight, isn't it, and focus your mind, and kind of put the two kinds of meditation we're going to do right now. One is a so-called placement or concentration meditation, but you place your mind on some object like the breath. Could be, you could visualize some, you know, in the text they often say visualizing an image of the Buddha, but that's a little bit hard to do. The breath is readily accessible, so you can focus at the tip of the nose or the rising and falling of the abdomen, and just watch your breath, and then in a few minutes I'll start, lead a little guided meditation, that's the other kind of meditation. It's more contemplative. Okay, so we'll start out like that. So take a moment to examine your motivation or your reason for being here this morning. That's just part of your awareness practice. Like, why did I get up and drive all the way over to Kadampa Center? Like, what's in it for me? Why am I here? Everybody's here for the, roughly the same reason. You know, we don't want to. We want to find something positive for our minds to make us happier. Maybe it's curiosity, but still, underlying all of that is because we're constantly driven by this, whether we're aware of it or not. The desire for happiness and the desire to avoid suffering. At some level, we're just exactly alike in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. And that's why we're here. Now, there's a motivation that we call in Tibetan, in Mahayana Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, being one example of that. Zen also is a Mahayana, Chinese Buddhism. They're all in that same school of Buddhism. But the principal motivation for practice is you need to train yourself this way because it's not natural. It's actually for others. We practice in order to develop ourselves in as fully as we can, you know, eliminating our faults like anger and jealousy and stress and pride and arrogance and all those things that obstruct our, you know, that whenever our mind is pervaded by these so-called negative mind states, we're agitated and we're not happy, depressed, whatever. We want to be free of that, and we want to develop all the positive qualities because they make us happy. Compassion, wisdom, joy, freedom. We want that. So the purpose of practice is to develop our positive qualities in order to be able to be a perfect guide and servant to others. So eliminate our faults, develop our positive qualities, so that we can help others. The purpose is to help guide others. As much as we can, we try to align our motivation with that kind of thinking. Even though it's not natural, it's kind of effortful at this time. It's okay. Coffee. today, I think that today was titled, what was it titled? Does anybody else, does anybody care? But did anybody read what this was supposed to be about, the conversation? Good. Nobody knows, so I can make it up. Probably a good thing.
One of the 16 guidelines?
No, it could be, though, but it's not. I decided, since I'm not paid to work here, I don't know what the word is, license to go places and talk about things that I think are important, that I think are interesting. So I'm going to write some quotes down, and some of these people that said these things you're going to recognize, and some of the people you're not. But I want you to, really the point, what I wanted to address today was, I think it's a wrap that spiritual practice, Buddha, religion in general, spiritual practice maybe too, you know, as well, gets this particular wrap that, well, you know, if you're a spiritual practitioner, fun is over. Can't go to Disney World, you just have to. I mean, I'll give you a little quote here just to set it up too. I remember my first experiences in Tibetan Buddhism, and as I was studying it, I thought, wow, this covers every aspect of my life. It's kind of like I was talking to a monk, I believe, and I said, it seems like it's all or none. Like, you're either in or out. And he said, no, it's monk or none. I didn't want to hear that. But obviously, we have, our teacher's a monk. He's been a monk since he was about 6 or 7. I mean, obviously a novice monk when he was like 6 or 7 years old. And he's not here right now, obviously, but Geshe Gelug will be back in a few weeks. Geshe Sampo's been a monk since he was a little boy. And then we have three nuns now that are here. So there are a subset of people that really want to practice, more, you might say, pour their whole life into it. There are people like that. And I don't have an eraser. I can't use my hand. The first quote is, again, this is all having to do with fun. Please don't take this as a sexist remark, because it could be girls, boys. This thing's running out already. What's the next line? Huh? I just want to have fun. And that, I think it's Cyndi Lauper, but I'm not sure. Is that right? Just want to have fun. Cyndi Lauper. I'm thinking today, we're breaking some new ground here, but I think, really my intent is to generate more questions than necessarily answers. There'll be some answers because I do have some content I'll cover, I promise. But and the other one, this one I heard as recently as yesterday. Hannah Brown. I'm bored. I'm not having fun. This is from an 11-year-old. Okay. Okay, now. Let's see. I had several more. These pens are dying left and right. Tim, where are you? They're all impermanent. Thank you, Chris. We're moving over to the maroon ones now. That's appropriate. The this one you can't read. Okay. Yeah. Oh, I just have to deal with it. The purpose of life, are you ready for this? Is to lead all sentient beings, SBs, or living beings, is a more common term, living beings. Wait a minute. To supreme enlightenment. And then lastly, Das Lama Zopa, Lama Tupin Zopa Rinpoche and Guru Shakyamuni Buddha. Yeah, this is the Buddhist presentation of, I mean, that's the point. The whole purpose of life is for that. And then, let me see if I can say this the way this guy said it. Isn't, these things are dying. This must not be very important because there's no ink left to make it come out. Yeah. Here we go. Isn't. Now, this is really important because this last one, I assert, is the cultural conversation that we all live. It's the air we breathe. And we're not even aware of it most of the time, but I think it, I'm going to say I would like you to, we can debate it for sure. That's the other thing, nice thing about Buddhism for those of you that are new here, you don't have to believe a word of what I'm saying. It's, the Buddha said, look, challenge everything, see if it works. If it, does it make sense? Does it fit your experience? Does it help you? Does it hurt you? If it helps you, then you might want to look at in, adopting it into your life, but isn't that what it's all about? Having as much fun as we can while we can. I'll only give you his initials. Alright, isn't that what it's all about? Does anybody see that? I see it in my life a lot. Don't you think there's something to that? Anybody got a problem with it? Do we have a microphone? Because this is not supposed to be just me talking the whole time. But is there anything here? Anybody got a? Because there's a lot of different points of. Well, there's only a couple of different points of view here, really. But the last one, in a way, I think it really. It's asking us also, what does the word fun really mean? Like, what is fun? Can Buddhists have fun? Go ahead, Chris.
That kind of goes against everything I've thought or been taught here at Kadampa Center. I'm sorry. I mean, you can have... maybe it's just my definition of fun, because...
Yeah.
Isn't it all about compassion and wisdom? And I guess you can rejoice if you help with the suffering of others.
Uh-huh.
Is that what you mean by fun?
Good question. What do you mean? But like obviously, you have something else in mind. What do you mean by fun? When you say fun,
well, when I
you say that's against the Dharma. You say fun's anti-Dharma.
No,
everything you've been,
well,
every opposite
no,
of everything
you've learned.
I'm
willing to look at the definition of fun. But when I see that up there, the way you presented it, I think of driving off the Porsche parking lot in a 911 Turbo, you know,
uh-huh.
And going to the disco. Although that's kind of, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, like partying down.
Right, right.
Yeah, all right.
So I think. What do you mean by fun? That's the big.
Good question. So does anybody want to tell us what their definition of fun is? Is this one being streamed, Chris? Millions of people are watching, so just be careful. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm not sure exactly what I think of when I think of fun, but I guess what I do think is short-term. Because I wouldn't think of, I guess, short-term enjoyment is what I would think of when I think of fun.
Because
even if I might enjoy, I wouldn't think of, you know, pursuing a lifelong career in X or something. It's fun. It's more this kind of short-term, short gain, short enjoyment.
So some kind of pleasure, would you say? Pleasure, fun equals pleasure, or sort of, kind of?
Yeah, any kind of enjoyment.
Yeah. So you could actually enjoy robbing a bank if that was something that got, you know, or, you know, if you were a rapist or... whatever, a molester. You know, you could have fun doing a lot of things, couldn't you? Depending on your mind, right? So, but it's short-term enjoyment. That's fun. A little tricky, isn't it? Yeah, Chris. Right.
I think the second one from that great philosopher Hannah Brown says a lot about the way we think about fun now. It's the opposite of being bored. We can either be bored or can be having fun. And it kind of implies that just change, doing one different thing after another, is somehow inherently enjoyable.
Yeah.
As long as we don't get bored, that's really the enemy. Yeah.
Boredom is the enemy. By the way, I'm here to learn today. I've been asking everybody I know for the last few days, what do you think about this? Excuse me, go ahead, pass it to the back.
Thank you. I was going to say, fun to me is the ability to enjoy myself in the moment, but it has to be free from worry, and I have to be on the path.
Mm-hmm.
It is conditional.
Right.
The ability to sit down and just in any instance in time and enjoy yourself,
right,
and to feel that pleasure, a lot of things have to be in place.
Right.
And free from worry, free from stress, those are the things.
Mm-hmm. So you can have, you know, we were talking over coffee yesterday morning, we were talking to a friend, and he said, you know, I enjoy, you know, fun for me is like a nice conversation with a friend, you know, like talking about something that's meaningful, or like having a great meal with a friend, or, you know, and, you know, sharing a bottle of wine if that's what you want to do, or it could be going to the state fair either by yourself with other people and having, you know, but it looks to me like fun is something that you do with your body or your speech or your mind. But ultimately, the mind is the determinant, isn't it? Because you could be doing something one day that brings you fun, and after you've done it for 30 days in a row, you're bored. It doesn't cause any more. I mean, the fun's gone, isn't it? So it's not inherently in any particular experience that we have fun. Yeah. Go ahead, please.
Hi.
I'm going to explain why the more you do something, the more dissatisfying it is in a minute. That's the one piece of information you'll get.
Well, nowadays, when I think of having fun, it doesn't involve any regrets afterwards. And I don't know how many people in here had fun in the traditional ways that, what was it, Chris was talking about, you know, going and partying down, and the next day you're like, why did I drink so much beer or whatever? And it's like, I wouldn't do something now, I wouldn't call that fun, you know, if you're going to suffer for it the next day or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, this brings up another point that I think is directed against Buddhism and, you know, any religious traditions in general, but Buddhism has an answer for spontaneity. You know, you hear this sometimes, people say, well, all of these rules and there's like so many vows and, you know, there are five lay vows. You know what they are? Anybody? Raise your hand if you know what they are, you get a, Robbie doesn't count. You go ahead, what are they? strictly speaking, it is defined that way. Although when I took the lay vows, Lama Yeshe, there were five of them, and the teacher who I took refuge with many years ago, I was in Nepal with about 200 people, and most everybody had come to Kathmandu for the drugs. So, you know, because marijuana was all over the place, and it was pretty. Well, I don't know if they were or not. They could have been, but my point was, you know, he just said, look, Lama's point was, look, just set some limits on your behavior, whatever it is. If you know, if you drink, if you smoke all day long, then make a vow to smoke half the day, you know, or whatever, or, you know, but he said that, but traditionally the five lay vows, and it makes sense. If a whole society lives this way, then you're going to have probably fewer problems. But avoid killing, right, stealing, lying, adultery, and getting loaded, getting intoxicated. So it could be, you know, beer, alcohol, any kind of drug, something that's going to alter your ability to be aware and present. So if you live by those vows, you go, oh my gosh, all of a sudden, if you take those vows seriously, you go, well, there goes my spontaneity. I can't have fun anymore. I can't, you know, I've heard that before. I heard it in my own head, but I've heard it from other people. What do you think about that? I think it gets back to what you were saying just now. Go ahead, Chris. What do you think about it?
I kind of had a mind blank when you said, what are the five lay vows? But I do know them, you know, no killing, no stealing, no sexual misconduct, no drinking, no, oops, what was the fifth one?
Lying.
Yeah, no lying. And I'm not bragging here, but maybe I had that mind blank because I really do try to live that way, mm-hmm. and it just like has become the way I live. I'm not bragging.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that.
Right. I think
saying, well, how do you get oxygen into your body? And you really got to think about, oh, it's because I breathe. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. This is my answer to the spontaneity thing and vows and stuff like that. If being spontaneous means that you drink so much that you have a hangover the next day, or that you do something to somebody else that's not only that's harmful, either emotionally or whatever. I mean, if you in your moment of spontaneity, you created a big icky mess, right? But you got to be spontaneous and you had fun. But the results of it are a big mess. Is that the kind of spontaneity you want? So in Buddhism, you know, there's a real, they talk about the vows as actually being freedom. Because the spontaneity that comes that harms others is not spontaneous. It's just our habit from beginningless time. We have trained ourselves to follow the mandates of our ego. And it's, the ego has habits. And so if we give in to the ego's sort of impulses, we will always lead, it might lead to short-term pleasure and maybe fun, but it always leads to long-term suffering. That's the point in Buddhism. So as Chris was saying, you know, if we can set some limits on our behavior, I mean, as she said, just take one vow. Don't kill. That's huge. Don't kill anything. That's huge. If you decide not to steal, that's even better. Or steal less. But, you know, he really did encourage people to just set some kind of real limits on their behavior, because there's no freedom in being a slave to conditioned mind, which is what happens when we behave spontaneously sometimes. However, as over time we can train the mind to actually make better choices by taking some vows. So within the vows of, like people get married, I mean, a lot of people get married and they take a vow to, like, be with this person. Now, some people don't, they ignore that vow and their marriages don't work out very well, but the ones, you know, the people that have successful marriages that have made a vow to stay together and to not cheat and blah, 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 they can still have a whole lot of fun and they can still enjoy themselves, but they're doing it within some limitations that they placed on that particular relationship. And it's the same way about our lives as a community. If we have vows not to kill, which is antithetical to the ego, isn't it? The ego wants to defend itself and go hunting and do whatever it wants to do, but not to kill, not to steal. Sexual misconduct means harmful sexual activity, but it also has to do with having sex with somebody else's partner. Not to lie, not to get loaded, because when you get loaded, you could do all the other four and not care about it. So, if we live within those kinds of vows, they're like a little fence that you might put around a seedling, you know, a little tree that you're trying to grow. It's a way to protect it from these impulses that could lead to harmful choices. So from a Buddhist perspective, being spontaneous, i.e. following the impulses of our conditioned mind from beginningless time, which is driven by egocentricity, that's not freedom at all. That's not freedom. That's bondage. That's not the kind of freedom we're looking for. We're looking for freedom that's joyful and actions that create the causes for more happiness, not more suffering for us and others. So there's a different, you know, there's an important distinction that we need to make about freedom. And fun, I think a lot of us equate fun with pleasure. We use that word. Let's talk about, I'm gonna write some things down here, and I'm afraid if I bend down, I won't be able to get back up, so I have to be careful here. I don't want to erase this, because I think I'll save it the next time, but I'll leave the chair over here. All right, so these are, this is another thing that I think Buddhism gets a bad rap for. All right, so these are, I'm going to call it, these are the sources of fun, pleasure, whatever. Okay? Now, over here is everything that you can ever think of. It doesn't have to be these four things I mentioned, but it includes, it's, you try to imagine that these four categories subsume everything in the world that's delicious and desirable. Okay? So the first one is pleasure. And over here is everything that we think is undesirable. So what's the opposite of that? Pain. Don't want that. All right. Then over here, gain. Now, pleasure is the, is, you know, body, you know, physical pleasure, mental pleasure, which obviously is in control of the whole game, but verbal, speech, physical, any kind of pleasurable experience that we would, that would be associated with a positive feeling, okay? Gain could be gain, you know, we think of material gain, but it could be gaining a relationship, children, money, job, 401k, Mercedes. What were you talking about, Chris? Yeah, 911 Turbo. But anything that's, and then the opposite of that would be lose it, right? Loss. If you lost that 911 Turbo, you lost that marriage, you lost that child. Oh, that's going to be tough. That's going to be painful. All right. Then the next one is pleasure, gain, fame. Also, we could think of it as like good reputation. And supposedly, I'm not sure I believe it, but I've heard it said, this is the one we're most attached to, by the way. Good reputation. And then, let's see, fame, disgrace, like, right? Bad reputation. When you see your face on the front page of the News and Observer on Sunday morning for something you did wrong, you don't like, we will not have, that will not be a good day. All right? And then, pleasure, pain, game. Hold on. Pleasure, gain, fame, praise. Alright, praise. I like to think of it as like approval. Same thing. Okay, think of it like that. Because how many of us like approval? Oh, we are like, you know, we walk around like, would you please like me? Oh, please like me. You know, we're all that way. We all want approval. We all want to be praised and told how great we are. And we don't want to be blamed or disapproved of. Right? Disapproval. All right. Now, I'm going to say that there's really not a line there, but because this is just the flip side of this, isn't it? You know, if there's going to be pleasure, the flip side of it is pain. Because nothing lasts. None of this stuff lasts. You know, all these things that we strive for, they don't last. There's a great Buddhist teacher that I was fortunate enough to meet in Thailand before he died. His name was Achin Buddhadasa, and he was considered in Thailand at the time to be like a saint. And he said where his definition of his way of breaking this down was saying we're all addicted to deliciousness. We're addicted to deliciousness. So everything that's pleasurable that makes us feel good. You know, we're so feeling oriented, and this is why it's really important to pay attention to our feelings. I mean, Buddhism is not about shutting down feelings. We have to know what our feelings are because we're addicted to pleasant feelings. So we need to pay attention to that. So he said, now, to the degree that we're addicted, and what do I mean by addicted? What do you think I mean by addicted? Let's hear from the back of the room over there. We haven't heard anything from the newbies. What do you think I mean by addicted? Got any thoughts?
That we need it to survive.
Yeah, it has a feeling of clinginess, wouldn't you say? Stickiness, clinginess, grasping. We use the word grasping a lot in Buddhism. It's like mentally we cling to this. We cling to everything that's delicious. That's what we get up in the morning. We want these, don't we? We go to work for this. We literally live our lives in the hopes that we can get this. And I would say these are the sources of pleasure, and these are what JB's talking about when he's talking about fun, too. A lot of it has to do with this. So the more that we cling to pleasure, can we avoid these? Is there any way to go through life and avoid pain, loss, disgrace, and blame, and disapproval? Heck no. Now, the more we cling to this, the more we what when we get this?
Suffer.
Call it what you want to, but it's painful. We don't want it. Now, some people go around thinking, well, Buddhism says you can't have pleasure, and you can't go to Disney World, and you can't, have a great reputation and be well thought of, and people praise you. There's something wrong with, there's a whole conversation which I think is bogus. But people think, oh, these are bad things. We need to avoid these. You know, if you get pleasure and gain and stuff like that, if you get that 9/11, somehow that's a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. It's just a thing. It's the attachment to the gain and the pleasure and the fame and the praise, the clinging that creates the problem for us, that causes us to suffer when we lose the pleasure. When the pleasurable experience ends, call it a good meal, maybe it's intimacy, whatever it is, but it doesn't last, does it? Its very nature is to not last. So when it ends, we're either left here in sort of la-la land, in neutral land, wanting to get back over here, and when we get what we don't want, which is the opposite of it, wow, we suffer. So it's the same thing. The more we cling to deliciousness, the more we suffer when we lose it. And what do we cling to more than anything? More than anything, and it's not this. Pardon? Ourselves. We cling survival. That's our instinct. And so the more we cling to our sense of self, which in Buddhism is kind of interesting because there certainly is a self, but it's not. But the self that we talk about in Buddhism we've been deluded for many, 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 many years. In fact, this whole lifetime, to believe that we are somebody we're not, and we cling to this false sense of self. And when that self is getting ready to die, we freak out because that's all we know. That's who we are. So we cling for survival, right? And it causes a huge amount of suffering. So what's so Chris, go ahead. You got to know.
I was just gonna, the root. They call it the root delusion, don't they?
The clinging?
Right. The ego. That's the root delusion.
That's the root delusion. That's the tap root for all the suffering. Absolutely. So what's the answer here, if there is such a thing as an answer?
Emptiness and compassion.
It is. What does that mean? What does that mean? Emptiness and compassion. I mean, we used to have a sign in the old center. If those of you who remember those days before we moved here, you walk in the door and it's a quote from Lama Zopa, and it said something along the lines of live with compassion, work with compassion, enjoy yourself with compassion, and die with compassion. Something like that. But it was, the key was, yeah.
I think it said, if problems arise, approach them with compassion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the last line. So, yeah, so all of it, so compassion is a key part of it. It's a key part of it. But just from a very practical point of view, for us, I mean, when you walk out of here today, I can promise you, if you're unhappy about something, you're clinging to something. If you go home and you're bored, it's because you're clinging to being stimulated, right? If you go out of here and you feel pain in your knees and you can't stand it, it's because you're attached to pleasure. You like it when at least you're neutral and not having pain. So the point is, that we can't avoid this. We're going to have some pleasure and gain in all this, and we're going to have some of this. So to the degree that we can be in the moment, live in the present, which sounds like a platitude, but just bear with me, but live in the present with compassion and wisdom. That is, we don't cling to pleasure. We can have, this is how we can have pleasure. This is how we can truly have pleasure. In fact, the pleasure that we have now, Lama Yeshe, when he was asked this question about, well, it looks like Buddhists can't have fun, he said, au contraire. He said, the point of Buddhism is to have bliss. Forget about fun. Let's have bliss. Like fun beyond your wildest imagination. It's called nirvana. It's called enlightenment. Well, let's have, you know, way more fun. But let's not think that ordinary worldly fun is the best fun there is. There is a kind of a fun that depends upon the mind being free and being motivated by wisdom and compassion. That's amazing. So to the degree that we can experience pleasure without clinging to it, we can really enjoy it, right? Because we're not afraid of pain. The more we cling to the pleasure, the more the flip side of it is, I'm afraid of pain. The more I cling to pleasure, at that very moment, I'm fearing pain. It's there in the experience. The fear is there in the experience of the pleasure, even though I don't recognize it. The fear of losing that 911 when you drive it off the lot, when you cling to it, when you identify it as me and mine, you're already worried about somebody, you know, keying your car or bumping into it. It's right there in that moment. So the more that we cling to these, the more we suffer. I'm saying it over and over again. The more we cling here, the less enjoyment we have when we actually have these experiences, and the more we suffer when we don't have them or when we get the opposite. Like on this line is when we don't have them. Well, if you cling, if you don't have it and you're addicted to it, like the junk, like the, you know, the crack cocaine or the whatever drug it is of your choice, when you don't have it, what do you want? You want the fix. You got to get back over here and get the pleasure from the junk. So it's very, very interesting. So letting go. This sounds so crazy. Just letting go. Letting go of the attachment to pleasure. Letting go of the attachment to gain, fame, and praise. It's just simply letting go. Simply letting go of the attachment to not experiencing pain. I am attached to not experiencing pain is a kind of clinging, isn't it? Isn't it? I'm attached to not experiencing pain. Said another way, I fear pain. I'm afraid of pain. I don't want pain. I feel aversion to pain. So the, you know, letting go of the aversion. So when you have pain, which you're inevitably going to have, you're sitting in the hospital, you got a broken leg, or you got pneumonia, or somebody just cut you open to take out a cancer, or whatever it is, or you're on a ventilator, or whatever suffering, or you're depressed, or you're stressed, whatever it is, you know, being able to let, you know, to experience that discomfort without wishing it were anything different than what it is, not exactly like buckling under and saying, I don't care, but it's like, okay, I can accept it in the moment. Now I can make it better too. But not resisting what is. Yes.
Okay, I'm just curious because you and Robbie are both doctors. So you know that when somebody has altered brain chemistry, a lot of times they go and they try to seek pleasure, you know, they use drugs or whatever, you know, trying to seek pleasure. For those people, it seems that it's a lot more difficult for them to let go because their brain chemistry isn't, you know, it's off. So, just would you address that?
I'll let Robbie talk about that. you know, I think that's karma. That's just their karma at that particular moment. Although I know that people, you know, I've seen plenty of people beat addiction. I've seen plenty of people not beat it. It takes a huge effort over time to change your mind. I mean, that's why, you know, I have friends and I know people that go to AA 2 times a day for years. Why? Because they have an addiction and they can't control their impulses and they need the support. This is why spiritual community is really important. Well, you know, and people come every Sunday a lot of times because we, this is a place where, you know, we may not be dealing directly with some, you know, heavy addictive thing, but it, you know, they get that kind of support. It takes a lot of time and training to change the mind.
Yeah. I was going to comment on that as well. I think sometimes too, I mean, it's not a hard line between, you know, what we consider addiction versus just pursuit of attachment. I mean, addiction is attachment for something that they crave. But, you know, when you talk about brain chemistry, people think, oh, alcohol, that's an addictive substance. Oh, cocaine, that's addictive. But what about gambling? What about, you know, sexual misconduct? What about cheating? What about, you know, kleptomaniacs who steal? There's also, you know, what about watching too much TV? What about playing video games? What about procrastinating? There's all sorts of bad behavior that we kind of pursue against our better judgment. You know, and I think that's all kind of, it's just a continuum of things that we all face on some level.
Yeah. We're all junkies, just different junk. Yeah. We all have our areas that we need to work on. Now, this is what Lonnie Eshi would say. He said, you know, try to pinpoint your top one or two delusions and work on those. Don't try to take it all on at one time. But, for example, if alcohol or, you know, or procrastination or, you know, boredom is your your Achilles heel, so to speak. Excuse me. Anyway, so anything else?
Just continuing with the analogy of addiction and junk, I think something that's helpful for me is to realize that the stuff on the left side there, the positives, it's never satisfactory. Even when we get it, we want more, and we have to have it in bigger amounts. You know, no matter how much gain you have, you always want more. It doesn't satisfy that attachment, that craving.
Right. You know, one of there are many ways to, well, Chris talked about this emptiness. That's a little hard. That's a hard one to use as an antidote, for example, to our addiction to, say, for example, pleasure. But something that leads in that direction toward emptiness, is seeing the impermanence of things. Like, for example, this doesn't last. So if we understand that when we're experiencing pleasure, whatever it might be, you know, there are a lot of people here that are married that have, you know, sex lives and enjoy intimacy with their partners and stuff like that. You know, understanding that that is not a permanent situation, that it's a temporary thing, and that then it's possible to actually have more pleasure than if we're addicted to the pleasure, for example. So it's not, Buddhism's not saying we, you know, for example, that, now if you're a monk or a nun and you have a vow to, you know, to celibacy, that's a different game. That's a different commitment, and that's fine. But Buddhism's not saying that it's wrong to have pleasure or to have fun. It's just, let's don't cling to it. And as much as we can, bring compassion into that moment. For example, you know, if you're with your friend, with your children at Disney World, you know, and or down at the beach and stuff like that, let's not forget our Dharma practice, you know? Like, for example, Lama Zopas gave a whole list of things at the Lamp to the Path retreat. He said, you know, when you sit down, think that, you know, I'm sitting down to, you know, liberate beings from the lower realms. So when you open the door, I'm guiding sentient beings from suffering to supreme happiness. Or when you are experiencing some sort of pleasure, like a good meal or good conversation or whatever, you can dedicate that pleasure to the happiness of all beings. Don't forget others. That's the whole key here, I think. Compassion is the wish that others could be free of suffering and the causes of suffering, and love is the wish that they can have happiness. So if you have if you see this beautiful sunset, offer it to the enlightened beings. If you have a pleasurable experience, offer it to the happiness of the enlightened beings or all living beings. In other words, This is a big part of Buddhism, is taking every, not leaving out any moment of your life as being distinct from spiritual practice. We can use every experience, pleasurable or painful, to wake up. Pleasurable or painful to create the causes for future happiness or future suffering, depending on the mind that approaches it. So it's not inherently bad or wrong to have any of these, is it? It's okay. It's the mind that we bring to the party, so to speak. I mean, we can have parties. You know, some people enjoy a drink. I'll finish up with a story. What time is it? Oh my gosh, I've gone over. But anyway. Oh, I do? Okay. Anyway, this story about getting back to intoxicants and stuff like that. There was this monk who, if I get this wrong, help me out here. But there's this monk and he lives in a cave, and he was doing solitary retreat for for many years. And his benefactor had, his benefactor's daughter was this really lovely, stunningly beautiful young woman who would bring him his food once a week. And then one week she came and she propositioned the monk, and he said, "I have a vow of celibacy. I can't do that." And then the next week she came and she said, "Well, you know, if you don't have sex with me, I'm gonna." She brought a goat. She said, "I'm gonna kill the goat." And he said, "Well, She said, "If you don't have sex with me, you have two choices. You either kill the goat or you have sex with me." And he said, "Well, I can't do either one of them. I have a vow not to kill, and I still have a vow of celibacy." Somehow he got out of that one too. And then the next time she came back, she brought like a big jug of wine, and she said, "Well, look, if you don't do one of these three things, then I'm gonna kill myself." And she had a knife this time. She was really serious. He thought she was serious. So he said, "Well, I can't have sex because I have a vow of celibacy. I'm not gonna kill the goat because I have a vow not to kill. And I'm also a vegetarian. I'm not gonna eat meat either." And then the wine looked pretty benign. So what did he do? Anybody, can you figure this one out? This is pretty obvious, isn't it? He drank the wine, got drunk, killed the goat, cooked the meat, and had sex with the girl. So he did everything. All of them, because he was intoxicated. So is a glass of wine a bad thing? No, but if it makes us stupid and do all the other bad things, then we need to not do it. You know, so getting high and stuff like that. So that's why Lama Yeshe said, at least reduce the intake of drugs. You know, go from a half a day all day to a half a day, or you know, whatever. But he, I'm not Lama Yeshe, although I did ask him to hang in there with me today. He's been dead for a long time. But anyway, any parting comments, Chris? You know, the part about emptiness and stuff like that, obviously that is the ultimate solution to this, is to see that, for example, this falsely projected sense of I that we have is the source of craving. And without that false sense of I, then there is no I that clings to pleasure and fears and dreads pain and all the negative stuff. In other words, the I that we believe and cling to so solidly, which Buddhism says is a fantasy, it's a fiction, is the one that's responsible for clinging. It's responsible for all the suffering in the wheel of life.
I was kind of going bare metal there, so...
I'm sorry?
I was like going down to the root teachings, you know, bare metal. And
yeah.
that was wrong, and you know.
Well, it's true. I mean, I mean, we can all see that, though, that every one of these is driven by a strong sense of I want pleasure. I want gain. I don't want pain. You know, that sense of I that feels so strong, particularly when we have a powerful experience of any of these, that inflated sense of I is the one that Buddhism says, that one is that's the delusion. That's the delusion. That's the false I. That's the one that doesn't exist, and we need to get a sense of it. It's called a dukkha, the object of refutation. It's like it's the false sense of I that doesn't exist that we need to be able to see through and operate. We do exist, but not that way. That's important. So yeah, so there is an I that can enjoy pleasure and gain and fame and praise and not create negative karma and not create the causes for future suffering. Yeah, and there's an I that can go through the hard stuff in life too and deal with pain and deal with loss and deal with disgrace and blame and not be totally rattled and depressed and end up on, you know, drugs and whatever. I mean, there's a way to do it with, and this is why we train. This is why the Dharma, you know, this is what Buddhism is about for many of us. It's like we know we have some work to do, so we have to train. This is not going to happen. We're not going to walk out of here today and have this like our lives are going to be different. But hopefully we'll be paying attention a little bit more to how our egocentricity and lack of compassion for ourselves and others and so on causes us to suffer. But, you know, I wouldn't disagree with John. I mean, JB, excuse me. I let's have as much fun as we can, but let's have the right kind of fun. The kind of fun that doesn't lead to future suffering. You know? End of discussion, I guess. Anybody have any other comments? Yes.
I was just kind of one last thing on fun. I thought it was interesting is, you know, the whole Mark Twain kind of definition of fun is anything that you don't want to do is fun, and anything that you don't want to do is work. Anything that you don't have to do is kind of fun. So.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I like Mark Twain. It's a good note to finish on. All right, so we have some dedication verses, and then you go back to the page, and I guess it's 36. Yeah, we'll just do those dedication verses on page 36, and maybe do long life prayer too of the Lama Zopa, and then what is that? They've done so many things to this book, I can't tell what it is. Okay, we'll just do that, and then the long life prayer for Lama Zopa, and then we'll do some mantras at the end. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow. May that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. O powerful Chinrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You uphold the subduer's moral way, her serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior, myself, and others, your disciples, please, please live long. Then at the bottom, there's two mantras. They come in, they're different tunes, and I can never remember. I've got one I like, a different tune than the one we usually do. It sounds a little bit like the New Christy Minstrels, which nobody remembers. He goes, Oh mani padme hum, 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 Oh mani padme hum. That's the mantra of compassion. And then Tara mantra. Again, I can't remember. So there's a different tune that I've learned of this one that I will do this one too. Om tari tu re soha. 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 Okay, so thank you for your attention. Now, one last thing before you go, I'd like for you to turn to somebody you don't know in here and shake their hand and introduce yourself and wish them a great day or happy life or whatever you want to say. But just introduce yourself to somebody new. Thank you.